It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 117 for Friday, the 29th of March, 2013. This week, we delve into the murky oceans to find out who's been taking ninja action on our planet's internet backbone. Plus, we get envious of the 17-year-old lad who sold a company he founded for $30 million. And we'll discuss the worm-like amphibian that munches on its mother's skin. Yummy. All that and more as we feast on this week's fleshy flank of Wired News. Ahoy, ahoy, I'm Nick Langson. I am the editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me, Wired.co.uk, is Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And Ian Steadman.
Hello.
There's the man himself. And introducing a new voice called Kadim. And this is what he sounds like saying, hello, thanks for having me.
Hello, thanks for having me.
There you go. Kadim has joined our team, and today is his inaugural venture as a professional podcaster on Wired's channel.
I'm very excited.
Good. Well, we're very excited to have you. You're going to be talking about some stories later. But first, we are going to start with Ian. There has been a massive cyber attack that we covered right as it was happening this week on Wired.co.uk. What has been going on?
A huge cyber attack. Perhaps the largest that's ever happened. It is apparently a dispute over spam. It's aimed at a company called Spam House, which I don't know if you've heard about. Is a non-profit organization that puts together lists of web addresses and servers and stuff that send spam out, which is quite a useful service. They kind of, other organizations download these lists and they add them to their spam filters. So people like Google and other large corporations use these lists. It's if you get blocked by this company, it's quite a big deal.
So they've annoyed someone.
Yes, they've clearly annoyed someone because they're being subjected to a massive distributed denial of service attack, or DDoS attack, where, you know, like a botnet or thousands of computers, roughly 30,000 at least computers, have been taken over and are just barraging Spam House's servers in London and Geneva with traffic up to 300 gigabits per second, which is huge.
Yeah.
Apparently, the kind of attack that might take down a large bank is only going to be 50 gigabits a second.
And this is 300.
This is 300, so it's huge. And 300 gigabits per second, to put that in sort of
context
is the problem, yeah. Context. That's kind of like a sixth of the total capacity of one of the major undersea transatlantic cables.
Wow.
So it's huge.
We're going to be talking about those in another attack-based story later on. That's pretty amazing. So, I mean, what did they do about this? I mean, this is a huge amount of traffic to stop.
Yeah, and the thing that was really scaring people was that it might overspill into the rest of the web. I spoke to Vincent Hanna from Spam House, who said, compare it to a big highway. If the traffic jam gets big enough, the on-ramps will slow down and fill up, and the roads the on-ramps will fill up too.
That's a bit too close of a description to the US senator who described the internet as a series of tubes. He said it's not a truck, which he's right. It's not a truck.
Yeah.
Actually, what would happen here is that everyone would just get off the road and drive through the fields adjacent,
and then the fields
would get jammed.
Yes, that is the worry, effectively, is that, you know, it's not going to slow down everyone, but, you know, there are going to be people in London. These are major kind of highways that can get clogged up here.
Yeah.
Alan Brown from UCL's Research Institute in the Science of Cybersecurity, which is a great name for a research institute, I don't know. He told me that this attack is building up to a major event. Many Dutch sites and our Dutch department, just because they have Dutch in the name, have been targeted by DDoS attacks in the past month. If this was an attack against US government resources, doors would have already been kicked in worldwide. So it's clearly huge.
So what's the Dutch link?
The Dutch link is... No one knows exactly who it is, but the main culprit is to do with a company called Cyberbunker, who are a server company in the Netherlands who work out of a decommissioned NATO bunker, which
That's
is exactly what it sounds like.
That's a great place to work out of, isn't it?
But they also, well...
That's very Wired. We should be in a bunker.
Yeah, but they have quite a strange ethos. They proudly say that they will host anything, as long as it isn't child porn or terrorism related. But that's still a lot of dodgy stuff that they've been linked with. A lot of shady Russian and Eastern European gangs and organizations and cartels and things. And recently, Spam House very recently added Cyberbunker's servers to their blocked list. Anything that was hosted on Cyberbunker would get blocked by many, many spam filters, which annoyed a lot of people.
Well, we are going to return to attacks on massive amounts of internet traffic, sort of, in a little bit. But next, I want to talk about a child, Liv. There is a very young entrepreneur, 17 years old, not old enough to drink, but old enough to get $30 million for a product that he developed called Sumly.
Yes.
Tell me of this child of whom I'm jealous.
Yeah, I guess he's kind of a young... He's not an... Was he, are you an adult if you're over 16?
No.
You can fight in the army.
Yeah, well, you can't drink. And well, if you can't drink, you're
you
a kid.
Kill a man legally.
Anyway, he's a very mature teenager. This is a guy called Nick Dalwazio. And he developed this app when he was 15. But weirdly, because it's only actually been going for about just a little over a year, maybe a year and a half, but his birthday fell kind of near the end of the year, so it's kind of spanned two birthdays, so he's now 17. But anyway, unless you've been living on the moon, you'll probably be aware that Yahoo has snapped up his app for $30 million, although that he will not confirm or deny that figure. But this is an app that actually just... It summarizes pages, articles on the web to kind of up to 400 character summaries. So it's kind of easier to digest, ways to kind of condense huge amounts of information very quickly. And it focuses on news.
And it's like natural language based stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's not like bullet points.
No. It uses natural language processing to create a kind of condensed paragraph, like a couple of tweets worth, so you can get a sense of what's going on in that article and decide whether or not you want to read it. And so, yes, Yahoo has jumped on board. I think there's a few issues around this purchase because there was a lot of hype over Summly.
Yeah, and it's only about 12 months or so after it launched, which makes me very, very curious.
Yeah.
You know, who cashes out after 12 months if the product is that promising? And they've closed the app down, haven't they?
They've closed the app down. I think there's a few things that are a bit dodgy about it. First of all, well, not dodgy, but interesting, I guess. Yeah. First of all, it has loads of celebrity investors and advisors. It's got Troy Carter, who's Lady Gaga's manager, Ashton Kutcher, Yoko Ono, randomly, and Stephen Fry. So it's got the most enormous amount of hype. That and the fact that this guy was only 15 when he developed it. So it's had the most ridiculous amount of hype. I guess that and the fact that the guy was 15 when he developed the app. So I guess on the surface, it looks like Yahoo could be buying some kind of much needed cool points, you know, getting all these celebrity investors involved. Yahoo's undergoing a period of massive change at the moment. But when you dig into the acquisition a little bit more, you discover that Summly doesn't even have its own natural language processing. It licenses it from SRI International that makes Siri. So it doesn't really have its own proprietary tools to do the key skill that it has.
So has Yahoo bought Nick? Have they bought the talent here?
Essentially, they bought Nick and two other members of Summly staff.
And his idea.
Yeah. And his idea and his, like, appeal, I guess.
I mean, I absolutely take my hat off to him. You know, joking aside, I think it's absolutely incredible that someone is smart enough to put that together.
Yeah.
At 15, cash out before he's even old enough to really take advantage of the money and get in bed with a company that's now got an ex-Googler at its helm and looking to build itself back up from whatever it is right now. I think it's awesome. But and I'll tell you what I think this will turn out to be. I really do think they have acquired bits of technology, ideas, and some stuff that they have actually developed.
Yeah.
I think what we'll start to see is some sort of Yahoo homepage that is able to bring in loads of different types of news that a customized homepage would want, and then offer you summaries on that homepage of news that Yahoo also, from its other technologies, thinks you'll be interested in reading.
Yeah.
Because there's no other reason you would acquire this and acquire it to people and shut down the app if you were going to do nothing with it.
No.
Unless you were trying to get rid of a competitor, which has happened in business a lot, but that's not what's going on here.
Well, they're saying they're going to use it across a number of different products. But one interesting analysis of the acquisition was that Yahoo's been having a few recruitment problems. It's been trying to go back and get some of its old employees to come back to the company. And they're, you know, a lot of people aren't keen on doing that. And so some have said that this is just a really great recruitment exercise by showing this really cool young guy as a kind of exemplary member of Yahoo. It's actually going to help attract better talent to the company. So
it's a bit of a publicity stunt.
Yeah, a bit of a, I mean, if you've seen the amount of coverage it's got, it's certainly
insane.
Worked.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the coverage it got was largely because of Nick and his age rather than...
And he looks like a member of One Direction, which helps as well.
He's a photogenic lad. I'll give him that. But did anyone use Summly? I never used it.
I did. I tried it. I went to meet Nick.
But you know, trying it is the journalist job. But using it, did you ever
use
it? Because I use so many products on a daily basis.
You know what? But he actually described when I met him that it's not really for a really high news consumer, if that's a word. Someone who consumes a lot of news, someone who's on Twitter, it's probably not for you. It's actually for people who aren't on Twitter but still want that some of that bite-sized information from good, credible news sources. Mm. And so it's weird because it's hard to judge when it's not something that's actually really for you, or at least what he didn't say it was for.
Didn't he develop it when he was struggling to revise for an exam or something? Like, that was the initial idea.
Yeah, he said that Google was inefficient on stage at the London Web Summit. He's like, I was finding Google a bit inefficient for my work, so I just wanted to make something better.
I can imagine it being pretty awesome for journal articles if you're a scholar or something like that.
Well, maybe that's what we'll see Yahoo using the technology for. They will, of course, not be doing it using undersea cables around Egypt, perhaps, because according to the Egyptian army colonel, or an Egyptian army colonel, Egypt's naval forces intercepted and arrested three scuba divers attempting to slice underwater internet cables this week. Now, these are the cables that carry massive amounts of internet and telecoms data between entire countries, sometimes entire continents. And this particular cable runs from southern Europe and delivers internet bandwidth, huge amounts of it, to France, Italy, Algeria, and Tunisia, heads out to Saudi Arabia, India, Bangladesh, Malaysia, Singapore, and others by way of Egypt. Now, this same cable was maybe not attacked, but it broke in 2008 and actually contributed to a series of faults that led tens of millions of users being literally cut off from the internet. Yeah. And so it's a controversial cable, and often they're just damaged by boat anchors. So if a boat parks and drops its anchor, it cuts through a cable. A lot of these companies that operate these cables have to go out and repair them as a result. But we're not entirely sure who the alleged culprits are for this case or who they represent. And it's interesting to think about who the culprits are, considering what a huge part the internet played in Egypt's 2011 revolt. And it wouldn't be surprising, I suppose, if any opposition activists were involved in this particular...
It seems like shooting yourself in the foot a bit, I think.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if it was if it was made up, or if it was a PR, it was like kind of a stunt to kind of get good publicity for the armed forces or the government, because they're not very popular right now.
Conspiracy.
Interesting.
There's a lot of...
I mean, as a story, it's fantastic. It's sad, but how would you even observe that someone was doing that at the bottom of the ocean?
Well, companies monitor them because they have to monitor for any potential threats, and they have to be able to, they can't just wait for the internet to go down before they go and look at it. They have to monitor all the time, and it's not that difficult to do that. I mean, that's the company's job.
Were they caught red-handed, or were they sort of caught in a flat in Cairo, or did they sort of James Bond style get them underwater?
I think they were caught as they resurfaced. I think they were monitored while they
resurfaced, had they already cut? What? Was this just a scouting mission? They were kind of...
Well, who knows? This is a conspiracy, and you've turned this into
This sounds a lot like the opening bit before the credits in a Bond film.
Yeah,
it does a little bit. Okay, well, I mean, they've been intercepted, so it's fine. We'll look forward to finding out who the culprits were, of course. Let's move to North Korea, actually. Another internet story. This is a bit of an internet crime and controversy-related week. We've been covering for quite a few weeks now how North Korea had finally enabled 3G data for tourists, and we've covered that a lot because Ian has been and visited North Korea. And this week they've revoked the access after a month.
They have.
What the H is going on?
Well, it's hard to tell, as of everything with North Korea, but this kind of goes back to, as you say, a month ago, they gave tourists the chance to use the country's domestic 3G data network. So if you went there as a tourist, you could access the web and download stuff and send emails, and it was all good. Apparently, the 3G network covers 92.9% of the country, so it's pretty extensive.
Does that cover the land of the country or its population?
I believe that's the physical country, but I do not.
The thing is, when you've only got 9 people allowed to use a phone.
Yeah, exactly. statistics, take it with a pinch of salt, I think. But it kind of all go back to, you always used to have your phone taken off as you went to North Korea. In January, they started letting people take their phones with them in. You could buy SIM cards when you arrive at the airport and make phone calls. Very expensive SIM cards, by the way. I mean, the only reason they did this is to raise money, because they really need some dollars. And that sort of last month they decided, oh, you can actually access the internet as well. But unfortunately, the most recent tour groups to go there have said that the regime's changed his mind again. You can still make phone calls, but you're not going to be able to access the web.
The regime's changed his mind again. Oh, was that a Freudian slip?
Probably, yes.
I find that this is... I want to call shenanigans in a way, because the time scale of this is far too... what's the word? Attractive. Think about it. It's a month. You could just imagine the conversation. Let's trial this for a month. Let's go from this date to this date and we'll just see what happens. We'll monitor it. We'll see if it's a good idea. We'll see if it can cope. And we don't have to give answers anyway. We'll just switch it off afterwards because, hell, we're North Korea. We can do what we want.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me at all if that's what it was. And for no explanation...
Well, they might have just run out of SIM cards. I mean, it could be something
But they wouldn't switch
simple.
The network access
No, the network access isn't switched off. It's just you're not going to be able to buy the SIM cards anymore, basically. If you're a permanent resident in Pyongyang, if you're like an aid worker or a foreign journalist, there aren't many there, but there are some... or you're a diplomat, you can still buy this and you can still access the web. But those people are highly monitored anyway. It was the fact it was tourists that was so interesting, because you're just a tourist. You're just some like backpacker schlepping around there and you can sort of take a photo and tweet that you're in North Korea. But you can't do that anymore.
They've been monitoring the tweets, probably,
yeah,
from people there. Thought, ooh, they're saying some nasty things. Oh. Don't know if we want this.
It's just been a mental week there, month with the whole Dennis Rodman thing and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, I don't really know how to predict anything that happens there, to be honest.
Well, you are kind of our resident North Korea expert these days.
Yeah.
I mean... you know, keep on top of it. I mean, seriously, what are you here for? Come on.
I'll give the palace a call and see what the rumours are or something. I don't know.
All right. Well, while Ian goes and calls the palace of North Korea to speak to Supreme Leader about his 3G network plans, Karim, get in front of a mic. We are going to talk about Facebook, which has let people in the UK call other people in the UK for free on Facebook. How revolutionary.
They've upgraded their Messenger app to allow voice over IP, so it's kind of like Skype or Viber now. So if your Facebook friend also has the Messenger app, you can give them a call and it'll use your data and not your minutes, which, as you say, isn't exactly revolutionary. It was rolled out in North America in January and it's finally arrived here. But you can only use it if you have an iPhone or iPad or iTouch, because Android users...
I have to stop you there. You said iTouch. Lose a point. It's iPod Touch.
I'm with you on that. They're really strict about... Apple doesn't like people saying iTouch.
No, I don't like people saying iTouch.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's a horrible word. Yeah, only because I reviewed
it. How is it any worse than iPad, iPod, iTouch?
It's not a real name.
So what? It's an abbreviation.
It's not the strictly commercial.
What about iGadget?
All right. So, Karim, let's carry on. This was rolled out in North America, as you say. Why would I want to use this instead of using Skype?
I'll be honest. I have little to no idea. I myself don't like using the Facebook Messenger app because it's annoying enough having people to talk to you on Facebook when you use the web version. Never mind having them chatting to you on your phone all the time.
But you can do
this. You know what? I think it makes loads of sense because you've already got all your contacts in there. You don't have to search for anyone's names. They're just there. So anyone who doesn't already use Skype, it cuts out a whole level of admin. It's not a big level of admin. And if you're already using Skype and have your contacts there, that's fine. But I think it makes it much easier. You don't even have to fanny around with random usernames. You use their real names. Yeah. And I think
it's Facebook encroaching on another part of our industry that we need to keep separate from the clutches of Zuckerberg. I don't want him on my face. What's he going to be doing now? Next, making my breakfast? No, thanks. Another way to monitor me? No. We had a story in the site about how advertisers in the future might be starting to use your own genetics to better monitor things that you are physically more likely to like want to use. Mm. I don't want this to be a step towards Mr. Zuckerberg.
But you love FaceTime, so you're...
I do love FaceTime.
Is that because you're an Apple fanboy, or do you...
No, it's because there's something quite satisfying about having a video call come in from your gran and thinking, my God, a pensioner's video calling me. I live in the future. That's great. Whereas I've been able to call people for ages. I don't know, No, I'm sorry.
Is it not video?
No.
No. But I'm not sure that allowing Facebook to make calls to your phone is necessarily the next step to the... dictatorship and tyranny of Zuckerberg.
Well, they've already got a dictatorship. I mean, they're basically North Korea, aren't they?
Yes.
Says Ian. No, I'll tell you something. I mean, it is a great movie. It's a little feature, really. It is just a nice tweak. I think what would have made me more excited about this as a story is if I was going to be allowed to call, say, landlines, or have people call me from a landline to my Facebook account, because that would be actually adding something to a service that we don't already have. I mean, you could already Skype people through Facebook. And I know this is like through the Messenger and through the iPhone app and what have you, and that's a phone, so it's more suited to being used as a phone. But in that case, why not go the next step and you know, bridge that and let me call the landline for free or using my Facebook credits or whatever. Yeah. That would be actually
a
business model as well.
Maybe that is the next step, though.
It may be, and we'll keep our eye on it. I don't know when it's going to be coming to Android. Facebook tends to just roll it out as it wants, so we'll find out. Thank you, Kadim. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we have got a couple of fantastic segments for you in part two.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. First of our segments, a recurring segment, actually. We had this for the first time last week. Let's start with Thank You, Science. So this week in Thank You, Science, worm-like amphibian feeds on mother's skin.
Yeah.
Controversial headline. Flesh-eating beasts live.
It's fairly, I mean, it sounds controversial, but it's true.
Well, put it this way, if I ate my mother's skin, I think I'd be in a bit of bother.
Yeah, but you're not a Sicilian. This is an amphibian that looks a bit like a large earthworm or a kind of a pink snake. It actually looks like something quite rude if you look at the pictures of them.
Which you can on wired.co.uk.
Which you can. And it's been found to feed on its mother's skin. This is a creature that has had me singing the Simon and Garfunkel Cecilia song for the whole of the week. Cecilian. They're breaking my heart. So anyway, this is a new species called the Microcecilia dermatophaga.
Ooh,
and good. Dermatophaga means the kind of mother skin eating.
Ah.
And it's been found in French Guiana. And it's been described by some evolutionary biologists from the Natural History Museum and Harvard. Now, these creatures are quite interesting because they've been around since way before the dinosaurs. They've been around for about 250 million years, and they've been hardly studied at all because they live mostly underground and, you know, they're worm-like, so people have tended to ignore them a bit. But they look like worms, but they have large mouths and sharp teeth, and their eyes are covered by bone, so they can't really see properly.
Like
and they
the
have
Zarlacc from Star Wars, Return of the Jedi.
If you think about Tremors, is that the film? Tremors?
Yeah,
a bit like that, but much smaller. And they have these tentacles on their head that help them detect chemicals in the soil, the kind of sixth sense, if you will.
But how do they detect mother's skin and eat it? I mean, well, are they that hungry? Or are there that few nutrients around?
Well, that's the thing. The mothers, first of all, lay eggs, and then the eggs hatch. And then the mothers, while the eggs are kind of gestating, they grow a sort of a fatty layer of skin, a kind of extra layer. So it's not, they don't get kind of all their skin removed. And so when the hatchlings arrive, they start munching on the mother's skin.
Yeah.
And they observe this because they saw that the skin colour of the mother was changing as these little hatchlings munched away. And the mother's weight was reduced as the hatchling's weight increased.
Now, I suppose, now I think about it, it's not the most audacious thing that we've seen in that sort of kingdom. I mean, we've had the, you know, we have the praying mantis that will decapitate its loved one. We have the spiders that literally lose their penises in order to keep their produce within the female. You know, I suppose eating the leftover skin, I mean, snakes shed their skin. I suppose you could eat that. I'm sure some beasts do.
Yeah,
some
and I guess, you know, mothers tend to nurture their young and feed their young.
I guess it's that sort of slightly incestuous undertone that's...
some humans eat the placenta after birth.
Yeah, I don't
want
to eat those
wrong.
People. I mean...
It's meant to be rich in iron.
I don't care. You can take iron tablets.
I agree. There's iron in Guinness.
Yeah, very true.
You know, No. Please stop eating placentae.
I'm with you.
There's
on that
plenty of other things to eat. So this is not the first time we've seen skin being used as food, though, is it?
No, there's actually two other Sicilians that do this skin feeding. So this is the third. But the interesting thing about this one is that it's not closely related to the others. They've evolved separately for more than 100 million years, at least they think it is. So that means that it's probably an ancestral characteristic for Sicilians. So that tells us a lot about how they've evolved, which is very cool.
It is, and very, very interesting. We've got one more story to come to. This is a new segment. Order, order. This is Order Order, a section where we talk about something in the world of law and perhaps order or disorder, actually, in this case. Twitter has been sued for £32 million for refusing to reveal anti-Semites, reports Wired.co.uk's Ian Steadman.
Yes.
Massively popular story on the site. I think probably our most popular story this week.
Mm.
What the H?
Well, it's kind of it's a classic collision of hate speech laws with the freedom of speech. It kind of, to go to the background of it, it goes back to January, where Twitter was sued for not handing the details of some of its users over to the French police. Because in October 2012, the top trending hashtag on the site briefly was one called Un Bon Juif, which means a good Jew in French, which was an anti-Semitic hashtag. People were tweeting anti-Semitic comments under it. So in January, an organization called the Union of French Jewish Students sued Twitter, saying that it wanted them to hand over the details of those people who had posted those tweets to the French police. And Twitter refused because, as far as they were concerned, it was just the platform that people were posting on. It's not responsible for what people write. It's just the medium.
Yeah, if people put offensive content on YouTube, it's not the product of YouTube, and they have to respond accordingly to individual cases.
Yeah. The Union French Jewish Students had also sued Twitter, and they wanted them to set up a system that would mean that Twitter would filter through the tweets that were posted as they happened in real time and filter out future instances of racism and anti-Semitism, which Twitter again refused to do because they said, we're protected under the... We're a US-based company, and we're not based in France, so we're protected by the First Amendment, which guarantees free speech. The judge disagreed, and Twitter lost in January and gave them 2 weeks to give up the information and gave them a possible fine of €1,000 a day for every day of the deadline. Now, Twitter just ignored that completely.
Right.
So now the union is suing Twitter again, saying that it's making itself an accomplice and offering a highway for racists and anti-Semites. And they're suing Twitter for €38.5 million, which is £32 million, in a civil case. The union has said that if it wins the case, it's going to donate all of the money to the Shoah Memorial Fund. It's not doing it for any kind of material gain. It's doing it purely to teach Twitter a lesson.
But teaching Twitter a lesson, this is surely teaching the internet a lesson.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, Twitter has just been, you know, singled out here. It's kind of been made as an example of, in a way. There are, I mean, the thing is, it's not illegal to be racist.
It is in France.
It is in France.
Yeah, this is the problem. It's in America, the focus is very much on freedom of speech, whereas in France, it's very much freedom from being offended. So hate speech, things like anti-Semitism, are illegal.
The hate speech, yeah, I suppose. I mean, being a racist itself is, I mean, it's illegal to deny the Holocaust in many parts of the world.
Yeah.
You know, certainly in Germany, it's illegal. But I guess it. Yeah, I'm not 100% clear on the law, I guess, on the difference between being a racist.
It's not illegal to be an idiot, so...
Yeah. Exactly, and you could make a racist comment and not be in trouble for it, but I guess if someone massive blows up and says, I'm hugely, hugely offended, then maybe that person is going to have what they said taken to be far more than they meant it to.
Yeah, in France...
Not to defend racism, by the way.
Yeah, in France, if you walked down the street and started shouting racial abuse at someone, you would be prosecuted.
Yeah, but
that.
You would have that in the UK as well.
Yeah.
Because that would be more like, you know, harassment.
Yeah, but you don't have that in the US. The US has total protection for freedom of speech.
But the US is slightly different in that sense, in that their actual constitution says that you can basically say what you want.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Twitter's relying on. They're saying we're an American-based company, and we agree with the philosophical backing for that, which is that we believe that you know, we're just a platform
but it's not going to
write on, and we're not responsible for that.
It's not going to stand up, though, because that argument is breaking down more and more, because if you operate in a country, then you have to abide by that country's laws. We see that with things like copyright infringement.
And the Lord McAlpine case as well. Yeah.
And China as well.
Twitter does actually filter tweets in Germany for neo-Nazi content. They were ordered to do that last year by a German judge, and they complied. And they use the same technology that they use in places like Saudi Arabia or whatever, you know, the countries where they can filter through for protest tweets. They filter through for neo-Nazi tweets in Germany. So they have the technology. They just don't want to do it because it's not very free.
It seems weird to pick and choose countries where you do that, though.
I think they're just waiting until they get told. I think.
I guess it's expensive to comply. There's a cost in compliance, but it's probably going to be an expensive legal process.
Yeah, the server cost of having to filter through the Twitter feed in real time, the Twitter pipe or whatever. What's it called? The Twitter stream?
The
hose pipe.
The hose pipe, that's it, yeah. Filtering through that in real time is going to be expensive.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we have quite the smorgasbord of comments underneath this story on Wired.co.uk.
Including some anti-Semitic comments. Yes.
Well, they're not, because we removed them. Because as far as I'm concerned, if you're chatting on our website, you're chatting in our house, and if we don't like you in our house, get out.
Yes.
That's the way we work. We are pretty liberal with our ban hammer, aren't we, Liv?
We are. Yeah. It's like we're the Phil Mitchell of the pub of Wired.co.uk.
We are the, what was that guy in The Omen or The Shining? The actor.
The Exorcist. No,
Jack
sorry.
Nicholson.
We are Jack Nicholson, and our axe is our ban hammer. The door is our website, and
we're destroying our door and poking our faces through it.
Yes.
And terrifying a woman and child.
This is vast becoming convoluted and possibly offensive. Who knows? Let's end the show, shall we, Liv? How do people get in touch if they want to get in touch?
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. We also have a delightful little Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And as ever, you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Yeah, do it. We read them. We love them, mostly. We don't like the spam. We get a lot of spam on that account for some reason.
We should stop giving the email address out.
No, let's not. Let's carry on. But for now, we are going to go and have a very over-commercialised chocolate egg weekend. Have a good one.
Bye. Bye. I mean, how long's a piece of string? Until capacity is reached, and that's, I've got expansive.
You're very capacious. Ian, what about you?